All right, please help me welcome Brenda Grantland.
In case you don't know the reference to FEAR in this, FEAR is a national organization that I've been on the board of directors.
Use the microphone.
FEAR, or Forfeiture Endangers American Rights, is a national nonprofit organization I've been on the board of directors for since it was started in 1993. And that's what I do my advocacy for. That's a volunteer job. I don't get paid for it. I'm a private defense lawyer. So anyway, cops love asset forfeiture, and they love it because it generates forfeiture revenue for them that they can spend off budget. And that's why they end up buying Hummers and all kinds of automatic weapons and military gear and things like that. Some communities, especially in poor areas where they're cash-strapped locally because of the state legislature, depend on it for forfeiture. Depend on forfeiture revenue to support the police, which is a very dangerous thing. And that's why there are all these forfeiture traps in places like that. This is the, these are the statistics for federal forfeiture revenue between the DOJ and the Department of Treasury each year from 2001 to 2013, the last fiscal year that's been computed yet. When Congress, this CAFRA is a federal statute. When Congress passed CAFRA in 2000, they thought it would reduce forfeiture revenue significantly, but they said it was a good thing because there were so many abuses. As you can see, it started to climb immediately. In 2001, $479 million in revenue. 5 years later, in 2006, almost three times that much. In 2012, which was 11 years later, more than 10 times the amount. Or about 10 times the amount, sorry. As you can see, it's not going down ever. That spike in 2012, I can't remember what caused that. Probably some of the big Ponzi scheme cases that brought in lots of revenue. But even after that spike, when it went back down in 2013, it didn't go down to the level of 2011.
Brenda, is that just federal too? Is that just federal?
That's just federal. And every state has their own state forfeiture laws. Nobody keeps track of how much is coming in from the states. California does report it somewhat. And some states, I think, have some reporting. But for the most part, they don't keep track of it because they don't want us to know how bad it's getting. So if you want to know what's driving this federal forfeiture enforcement, even in places where marijuana is legal, it's this revenue stream. And unfortunately, when a state legalizes marijuana, the feds' opinion is, it's not legal federally, so we don't care. These people are now sitting ducks for the feds because look at how easy it is to prosecute when you can just get the state records. People are forced to keep track of things by the state regulatory bodies in order to stay legal. In order to stay legal state-wise, they're creating the evidence the feds can prosecute them with. So until federal law gets changed, everybody has something to worry about. I just have to make sure that people know. The thing about it is, there's so many people they can prosecute, and only so many of them. The enforcement is sporadic, and you never know who's going to be the next sitting duck. People often say that asset forfeiture is like something out of Alice in Wonderland, punishment first and trial later. For that reason, I decided we should start with a pop quiz to see how much you know about forfeiture. If you don't know the answer, just guess. This is not for a grade. And I think what you're going to find is you learn a lot from seeing how wrong you were about your assumptions. First question, when was the first asset forfeiture law enacted? 1984, 1970, the Middle Ages, or the 5th or 6th century BC? I'm sorry?
5th or 6th century.
That's correct. It dates back to the Bible, the book of Exodus, which was 5th or 6th century. This is the actual first forfeiture statute. And let's see if you can guess the word that's missing from it. If an ox gore a man or a woman that they die, then the ox shall surely be blank, and his flesh shall not be eaten, but the owner of the ox shall be quit. What goes in that blank? Forfeited, forfeit, stoned, immersed, or confiscated?
Forfeit.
Anyone else? I think you'll be surprised.
I'll go for stone.
Stone. Stone is the answer. I thought you would enjoy this. This passage caused most of the mischief in forfeiture law. What it did was, it says that under this passage, the ox will be punished for killing a person. The person who owns the ox will not be punished. Now, the ox will be stoned to death, and his flesh will not be eaten, and the owner will not be paid for it. Isn't he being punished by losing his ox? It's a legal fiction. They say, well, the Bible says you're not punished, so you're not punished. This was the basis of the interim jurisdiction that's still around today. The property's on trial. That's why the case is called United States 1 versus 1 Chevy Tahoe or whatever. You are not on trial. You cannot be convicted or punished because the court has no jurisdiction over you when they have a civil in rem forfeiture case. And because of this, Congress and the courts are allowed to ignore certain constitutional rights that apply to individuals. They say that property has no rights, therefore there were no rights at all for a long time. The Supreme Court relied on this in saying that forfeiture, it's not a constitutional defense that you're an innocent owner. Your property can be forfeited whether or not you're innocent. It's irrelevant unless the statute gives you a defense. And some statutes had no defense. Until CAFRA, there was no uniform innocent owner defense. So in many cases, people fell through the cracks. They were completely innocent. The court would not let them prove they were innocent because it was irrelevant. Your property's guilty. Question three, how many offenses trigger federal forfeiture?
D.
That's a pretty good guess. Anyone else?
D.
Yes, it's either B or D. There are really over 400, but it's impossible to count them because of the way they've set them up. There's this one statute, 981, that gives a laundry list of several hundred offenses that trigger forfeiture. And it also incorporates another statute that incorporates all the definitions of specified unlawful activity in 1956. And that statute, in turn, lists a laundry list of offenses and then incorporates the RICO statute. So once you multiply by all of those different statutes, the list grows almost exponentially. The other thing is the RICO statute lists many offenses and then also list broad categories of crime. So if a broad category has almost an unlimited number of subsections. And the other thing is, there's a criminal forfeiture statute for many of the same things that there's a civil forfeiture statute for. Counting those makes it really, really hard because sometimes they differ just a little bit. So really, it's impossible to count. We know it's way over 400, probably 500 by now. And the other thing is, Congress can make a new forfeiture triggering offense anytime it amends the definition of specified unlawful activity, for example. If they amend that, suddenly there are more forfeiture offenses, but you don't see a forfeiture statute. Question four, does the Fourth Amendment exclusionary rule apply to civil forfeiture or apply in forfeiture cases? A, yes in criminal forfeiture only. B, yes in civil forfeiture only. C, yes in both. Or D, no.
No.
Did somebody say no? Actually, the Fourth Amendment applies to all forfeiture cases, even civil forfeiture. The Supreme Court, back when it actually was based on a constitution that was enforced in 1965, ruled that exclusionary rule applies to civil forfeiture. So by extension of that, in criminal forfeiture, you'll have the Fourth Amendment by virtue of the fact it's a criminal case. So it applies to all. Question five, does the Fifth Amendment privilege against self-incrimination apply in forfeiture cases? Any idea?
A, only in criminal forfeiture.
Yes, in both. Now, it's the reasoning of the case, the Supreme Court case that said that the Fifth Amendment applies in civil forfeiture cases has changed now. They no longer embrace the idea that that forfeiture is quasi-criminal. They've gotten away from that because it's not expedient, so that is no longer the basis. The basis now, though, is that if you have a civil forfeiture case, by its own nature, there is a triggering criminal offense. The fact that you could be prosecuted for that criminal offense gives you a Fifth Amendment privilege to not answer those questions. A lot of people give up their rights to forfeiture thinking that they can't fight it without losing their Fifth Amendment privilege. It's not true, you can. Okay, what about the Sixth Amendment right to counsel in forfeiture cases? Is there one?
No.
Good choice. There is none. The unfortunate part is often the government will take almost everything a person has, leaving them no money to defend themselves. And this applies to the criminal case too. And this has become more and more abusive over the last few decades. The government now will come in, they'll file criminal charges, they'll file civil forfeiture action and seize all the bank accounts. Usually they do that first, so you have no ability to hire an attorney before you get zapped, and then you have no money to defend yourself, and that's happening more and more to our clients. Is there a constitutional right to speedy trial? Any guesses? Yes, there is. In the right to speedy trial in criminal cases is based on the Sixth Amendment, which doesn't apply to civil forfeiture. But the Supreme Court decided that due process requires a speedy trial defense. So it's the same thing. It's not called speedy trial, it's called undue delay. But it relies on a Supreme Court case interpreting the speedy trial provision of the Sixth Amendment. Okay, does the Eighth Amendment apply in forfeiture cases? We know the Eighth Amendment involves punishment. Answer, yes to the criminal defendant only, yes to civil forfeiture cases only, yes in all of the above, or yes, but there may not be, but maybe not to third parties in criminal forfeiture. And E is none. Punishment, civil forfeiture is punishment according to the Supreme Court, and that is one of the major constitutional defenses now. In both civil and criminal forfeiture, if the punishment is not proportionate to the culpability of the property owner, then you have a defense. There's some variation between the circuits as to whether that culpability is measured by the culpability of the criminal defendant, who may not be the property owner, and And in some cases, they've gone so far as to say, as long as the value of the property is less than the maximum fine for that offense, not the maximum fine that criminal defendant could get for that offense under the sentencing guidelines, but the maximum statutory fine, then it's not disproportionate. That's really, really bad, because that's a Supreme Court, that's a constitutional right being determined by Congress's decisions on sentencing. And as you know, the drug war resulted in fines going up through the ceiling. So in some states, that's really hard to defend on. On the Ninth Circuit, there's a really good case. I think I talk about that later. Let's see. I did talk about that later. There's a really good case in the Ninth Circuit, just decided a couple of years ago. I'll tell you about it in a minute.
Brenda? That's an interesting statement you made, that last sentence there, of a case for applying that principle of excessive fines to third parties in criminal forfeiture cases. And it would seem to me that, since all those third parties have to establish is that their right was superior to the defendant at the time of the commission of the act, it doesn't seem like that whole issue of excessive fine will come into play for those third parties ever.
Well, that's in theory, but as you know, David Michael, by the way, is a forfeiture lawyer. As you know, if someone acquired an interest in property after the property was tainted, they not only have to show they have an ownership interest and the extent of that interest, but they have to show they were bona fide purchasers for value without notice. And because the courts ignore that fact, and they go, oh, you've got to have a criminal conviction in criminal forfeiture cases before you can take the owner's property. That's not true if they bought something after it was tainted. And I'm seeing a lot of cases now where they're going after those post-taint transfers and taking property from innocent people, and they go, you have no defense. I think the Eighth Amendment does apply to those people because it is punishment to lose your property. And I don't see how that is any different whether they call it a third-party hearing or a civil forfeiture case.
Nobody's done that yet, though, huh? Nobody's litigated that yet, have they?
I might have to soon. We're seeing whether they're going to relent. A lot of times you start presenting the constitutional issue that you're about to litigate, and they go, oh, let's just settle it. Here's a good deal. And that moots out a lot of those important cases, which is fine because clients can't usually afford to pay for the litigation anyway. Okay, is there a constitutional right to a jury trial in forfeiture cases? Yes, except for third parties. Criminal defendants have the right to a jury trial under the Sixth Amendment. Civil forfeiture cases have the right under the Seventh Amendment, which is based on whether that right existed at the common law when the Constitution was created. Unfortunately, for those third parties in criminal forfeiture cases who have virtually no rights at all, the courts have said, well, this is akin to a quiet title action. It's not the equivalent of a third party hearing. And as you see, that's based on what David Michael said about all you have to prove is that you own the property or you have a superior interest and you're out of the case. Unless you acquired your interest after it was tainted, in which case you slip through the cracks and you have no rights, including no right to, there's no right to a jury trial, period, in third party cases. One other way that those third parties really get screwed is a lot of times they'll say, well, we don't believe the third party who owns the title to the property is the real owner. They're the straw owner. And we're not going to allow you to defend this. The criminal defendant gets a plea bargain that says forfeit this property and you'll get a better sentence. And then the third party has nothing to lose because it's not their property anyway. They go, sure, go ahead. And then the government comes in and they say, well, you're the straw owner. You're not a real owner. Therefore, you have no right. There's no jury trial on that issue. So I think there are a lot of ways in which this new trend of abuses are going to turn into new litigation on constitutional issues.
What's the Seventh Amendment? What's the Seventh Amendment?
Civil cases, right to jury trial. Jeff is a criminal defense lawyer. Okay, question 10. In criminal forfeiture cases, the property owner must be convicted before his interest in the property can be forfeited. I think you can guess that based on what I just said. Once again, it's the third parties who acquire their interest after the property was allegedly tainted have no rights, really. It's outrageous what they do to them. They have to prove their bona fide purchases for value without knowledge of the offense that tainted it. Now, in cases where a family member knows family members is a drug user, seller, whatever, they have trouble proving, even if they paid for it, they can't say that they didn't know that it was forfeitable. So people who sell their property to their relative in order to purchase, in order to hire a criminal defense lawyer, often leave the relative in the lurch. I think this might be the last one, but I'm not sure. The DEA administrative forfeiture notice gives the claimant a choice. They can either file a petition for remission or a claim, but not both. Now, just to give a hint for those of you who don't know what these things are, in the notice from the federal government, it goes on at length about how you go about filing a petition for remission. Several paragraphs with the deadlines, what you have to do, etc. And then there's a paragraph, little tiny, two or three sentences saying, or you can file a claim. And it doesn't explain the consequences of these things. So you can imagine which one is the trap.
Remission.
Yes. If you file a petition for remission, you waive your right to judicial remedies unless you're allowed to do both. You have to file a claim in order to have any judicial remedies at all. And once you go into court, once you find out you've waived your remedies and they've given you a boilerplate letter denying your claim saying we don't find that you're an innocent owner or whatever, you have no right to appeal anywhere. You can't go to court. Court has no jurisdiction. You lose. So it's absolutely urgent, essential in any administrative forfeiture case that everyone files a claim. And some agencies allow you to file both, but when you do that, you put yourself in a position where your judicial remedies will be delayed until the petition for remission is decided. Those take 3 or 4 years often. All this time they've got your property, you're sitting there going, why did I do this? You know, you're better off just skipping that because they almost always deny them. I think Customs grants a few, but DEA never, as far as I know. David Michael, do you say ever? The DEA ever grants a petition for remission?
I've never heard of it in 20 years of litigation for cases. We always consider a petition for remission and negation to be equivalent to a slow plea of guilty.
Yes.
Where do you file the claim?
You actually, the notice, you don't actually file it. You serve it on the government. The notice will tell you where to send it, and it often has a post office box, and you have a 30-day drop-dead deadline. So you've got to send it in, and you see there's a post office box, and you're going to send it by FedEx. So you've got to get their street address to do that. So it's a real scary situation, that early stage, and that's where I'll go on to the next one before I give the next one away.
Can I make one more comment on that petition for remission mitigation? Brenda, okay?
Sure.
Yeah, there's another danger in the petition for remission mitigation because you're supposed to explain your innocent ownership of that property in that petition. You're given these administrative agencies, whether it's the DEA or Customs or the TSA or whatever agency that seized it, you're giving them a lot of information that they may not have a right to. And when you file a claim,
they are out of the picture. They no longer have any jurisdiction over the property when they file a claim. Their only job is to send it to the U.S. attorney in the district where it receives. So to me, I've seen many clients have come to me after filing these petitions for remission and mitigation, and they're saying all these statements, and they're not protected by an attorney. They don't know what they're saying. They file these petitions, and they just give all this information out to the seizing agency that you may not want that seizing agency to know, because when you file your claim, it goes to the U.S. attorney, and there's a number of motions you can file. And as Brenda knows, you can file all these motions in the district court when they file their forfeiture petition, forcing the government to prove up something before you have to give the government anything. So you lose all that opportunity and you give away a whole bunch of information to the government.
And you also may be incriminating yourself for a parallel forfeiture case.
Right.
A criminal case, it may come up a little bit later. They usually start with a criminal, civil forfeiture first, and they throw that out and they try to get people. The other thing the petition for remission requires is that you give them all your evidence. Isn't that? So I think the first thing you should tell any criminal defendant you have, they say they have property seized, is do not file anything until you come to me, because they look at this and it looks like an easy solution. And it's really a horrible trap, and I can't believe they're still getting away with it after 20-something years. But as you see, they depend on it now, so courts are going, well, we gotta fund them some way. All right, true or false, when you submit an administrative forfeiture claim, the mailbox rule applies, and as long as it is postmarked by the deadline, it is fine. See a bunch of people shaking their heads. No, yes, it's another trap. A lot of people call me up, lawyers, to say, I've filed my first claim in a forfeiture case, and they say it got there after the deadline. I mailed it first class mail, and it didn't get to them until the day after. Well, how do you even prove when they got it? That's the problem. I always send mine overnight, FedEx usually, to make sure I know I have tracking to prove exactly when they got it. And I recommend you send it ahead of time, because you don't want to take the chance of a snowstorm and whatever, or flood or whatever, in whatever state is going to delay the claim.
Can they not be filed over the electronic?
No, because it's not filed in court. The administrative process is done entirely inside the seizing agency.
Okay.
There's no judge. There's no hearing. You just submit your paperwork to the DEA, and they laugh at it and send you a form letter saying you just lost. True or false, Attorney General Holder ordered a complete halt to all federal adoptions of state and local police property seizures as his last parting gesture. Not really. It was widely reported in the press. In fact, some newspaper articles said that civil forfeiture has been abolished by Holder, and I was like, where'd they get that? And it just got more and more crazy for about a week, and I was writing people back on Facebook and everywhere I could think of. I finally wrote a blog article about two or three days later saying, that's completely wrong. This is full of holes. Here are the holes that Holder has in his own order. If the property was seized by a joint state-local task force that has even one federal agent on the task force, this does not apply. They can go ahead and use federal adoption. Oh, do you know what federal adoption is? That's where a state and local police seize property, not for forfeiture under state law, but to turn it over to the feds and have them forfeit it under federal law. It's often used because the federal law is harsher, and because the federal law gives the cops more money, a larger percentage. So it's become a real magnet for these dishonest state and local cops that are doing forfeiture traps and just seizing money on the side of the road. Anyway.
Why is it, excuse me, why would it be a benefit to the local cops to give it to the fed?
Because in some places, like in California, for example, state law gives the seizing agency like 60%, and part of it goes to the prosecutors, and part goes to the Department of Justice. So their cut is smaller under state law. Some state laws don't allow forfeiture for some things.
Tennessee takes it off.
Right. And some, yeah, some are worse.
100%.
Right.
They're going to take it off.
And so there's probably not a lot of federal forfeiture in Tennessee because it's easier for them to do it under state law.
Forfeitures that the feds are involved in, they turn it back to the state.
So, yeah, that's the way, it's whatever the whatever most benefits the government. And in some places, there's a defense, such as in Colorado. Now, I don't know the Colorado forfeiture law, but if something was legal, no, I don't want to give that away. That's another question later. All right, the other thing is, in any case where the prosecutor decides they want to keep this as a federal forfeiture anyway, all they have to do is go into court and get a seizure warrant, easy as pie. I don't know that the judges even read the affidavits. They just go, what does this say? All right, here you go. It's done deal, ex parte, no problem. Also, I've heard some people say the Cole memo has done some things. I've found the opposite, but maybe that's just because the Eastern District of California is deciding they're going to stamp out all medical marijuana, or at least my clients. And they're ignoring those eight factors that are supposed to be present before they go after a forfeiture case or a criminal case. Also, Holder's been replaced by Loretta Lynch, and she's notoriously a forfeiture hawk, from what I've heard, and bragged about it in her confirmation hearing. So I don't think it's going to even be in effect much longer. And I have not seen that it made any effect at all. I raised it in a case recently, and the prosecutor said, a very nice guy, by the way, he said, I'll have to check with my supervisor. And then he contacted me and said, my supervisor said no, because this isn't a federal adoption case, even though it came from a local task force, because it's a real estate case, and federal adoption does not apply to real estate, so it doesn't matter. I sent him a copy of the DOJ's annual report on their guide to equitable sharing of forfeiture proceeds, and there's a chart of what percentage are real estate, and he said, well, you know, we're not, and I thought, I know what he's going to do. He's going to get a seizure warrant, so why push it? So I don't think that did anything at all. It might have some kind of policy effect in some places where they want to be in compliance with the Holder. They go, okay, we're not going to go after these people. They consider it advisory, I believe. All right, I think this is the last question. Okay, go ahead.
I was just going to say, I had a case recently. A client contacted me regarding money that was seized in 2012, but apparently the FBI decided to send him another notice in 2014. This was out of LA. And we basically sent a letter to the FBI saying, this is illegal adoption, even though it happened in 2012 and they were still holding onto it. They agreed to send the money back. So, I mean, maybe some of the agencies aren't really aware of how.
No, it's not that they're not aware. They know that a lot of people that are forfeiture claimants are either going to be representing themselves, or they're going to hire a lawyer who doesn't know forfeiture law, and they just try it and see what will happen. And I catch, in a lot of my cases, I look at the case and I go, they did something illegal. And I send an email or a letter to the prosecutor saying, you can't do this because you've missed your statute of limitations or whatever. And a lot of those cases, if the AUSA knows me, they'll go, oh crap, she's going to make a big spectacle of this, and I'm going to have to do all this work. And they'll go, just give me some time to look into it. And they go, okay, we're going to give it back. And that's the best resolution anyway, because the clients don't have to spend a lot of money and time. But it's really crazy how often they'll do something like this knowing it's not legal. Okay, what quantity of drugs must be seized in a highway traffic stop in order to justify seizing all the money the traveler has in his possession?
Not any.
Not any is the answer. That's the biggest joke of all, is that most drug cases involve no drugs. Most drug forfeiture cases are just highway stops in which they use a bogus traffic stop where you swerved a little, we saw you change lanes unsafely. How do you disprove that? Now, you can if they have their cameras on. You can probably disprove that if you can get their camera footage. A lot of these forfeiture trap cases, as soon as they start getting prosecuted, you see that they're going to be based on either a drug courier profile, because you are traveling from out of state, you paid cash for your plane ticket or whatever. When I say forfeiture traps, they're wider than just car highway stops. They also stop in airports, bus stations, train stations. People think that, oh, maybe they're not policing there, and yeah, they are. And also, you send money through the mail or the FedEx or UPS, they've got drug dogs at those places too, so those are in the same category. No drugs at all, but large quantity of money seized, and they go, okay, it's drug money, we know it is. No prior conviction of the criminal defendant quite often. And there's, in many places, there is a presumption that if you have a large amount of cash, you have to be doing something illegal or you wouldn't be traveling with it. So,
do you know when that presumption kicks in? What amount of cash?
The presumption? It depends. I saw some cases, I don't remember the one in the Eighth Circuit that I just thought was outrageous. It's just a 30, 40, 50,000, I believe. I don't remember now. It depends on how much money the people in that jurisdiction have, I guess. Because if you are driving through a poor community and they go, what is somebody doing with $40,000 in their car? They must be doing something illegal, and you've got to deal with the jury that's going to be thinking that.
I don't think there's any presumptions in terms of the amount. From what I see is that it's the facts surrounding the stop and the seizure that they use to try to give them some justification to show that the money is related to some illegal activity.
There is an Eighth Circuit case saying there's a presumption from a large amount of cash. Also, though, it's often, like you say, it's circumstantial evidence, such as the fact that it has rubber bands around it, or it's in large and small denominations, or it's in $100 bills. It varies from scenario to scenario what's considered circumstantial evidence.
Well, the case I talk about tomorrow is a case that's exactly this fact situation, just as a case in point.
This is really what highway forfeiture traps are all about, especially in a poor community. And they'll often stop the people traveling in from out of state for two reasons. One is that if they end up going to trial, they're going to have to come in there from out of state and pay for it every time they go, and you can wear them down easily. But also, the locals aren't going to care about them, and they're going to say, oh, those people from California are all drug dealers. Let's take their money. We need it more than they do. And they love the fact that they're gathering up funds for law enforcement by enforcing it against out-of-state people. In the 1990s, there are all these studies, but Bo Edwards, who's now dead, unfortunately, uncovered these DEA studies in discovery in a case. Let me just see how much time I have. The study showed the DEA had tested the money, currency, the supply, to see how contaminated it was, and they also tested the belts at the Federal Reserve, that the machines that sorted the money as it went through, and they found like almost all the currency in circulation and those belts were contaminated. So even if clean money went in, those belts are contaminating it. So judges reasonably decided there's no weight to this. Forget that. Now they're doing it again. There's like, oh, the drug dog is infallible. We are now back in a position where we've got to start all over. That study by the DEA was years ago. It's different. The drug dogs are much better now, whatever. It's a convenient fiction for the police that those drug dogs are accurate. these are some brand new or fairly new tactics that are now available in these drug dog alert cases. And this would apply in criminal cases as well as federal, as well as forfeiture. U.S. versus Rodriguez was decided by the Supreme Court last month. A traffic stop cannot be prolonged to allow the, beyond the time it took to write the ticket, to allow a drug dog to arrive. Yay!
Are we using your written materials, the slides?
No.
Thank you.
But if you want, I think I'll probably put, I'll figure out some way to make those available to you.
I think Jerry Goldstein will talk about the Rodriguez case and when he gets his delivery on Saturday.
It's very important. It did not, I wish it had gone a little farther and said, but anyway, if Gerald's going to cover it, then he'll cover it really well, I'm sure. This is another, a scientific study that's extremely important. We used this in one of, a case that I worked on with a really dynamite criminal defense lawyer in San Francisco. Litt, Schweitzer, Oberbauser are the names of the, I think they're sociologists or some type of scientist. It was published in Animal Cognition Professional Journal. They did a study, it's fascinating to read, and you can find it on the internet at springerlink.com, that they tested to see whether the drug dogs were alerting to drugs or to what the handler's expecting of them and subtle cues and things like that. And they proved that the handler's telling the dogs what to alert to in many cases. Now, there may be some that are really good at it. I think the whole thing is probably a hoax, really. Especially since if we know the drug supply is contaminated, how are the drug dogs now so good at telling whether this is just generally contaminated drug? I mean, do they alert a different way for 0.05% or, you know, they shake all over if it's more? You know, it doesn't make any sense. Also, you should always ask for discovery of the drug dog's testing records. In the case that we had in the San Francisco, with the attorney from San Francisco, she fought for a long, long time and got the government to turn over the drug dogs' testing results, and they were really resisting this, so we knew there was something there. And it turned out that this dog had been decommissioned at one point for flunking out those random testing they have to do to make sure they're really proficient. And they put him on administrative leave for a while, didn't take away his kibble, and then when the coast cleared, they brought him back. So when she got all these things, it showed at some point, his test results were 50-50. Mm-hmm. We could have flipped a coin and gotten the same result. That case got us back because they won the criminal case, which was really good because there were a bunch of duffel bags of pot in this airplane. We got back the plane, the money, the truck, the generator, all kinds of stuff, a car, cash, and it was all because the drug dog, they were relying on that drug dog in the search and seizure. If there had been something else, they could have hung their hat on the other one.
Do you hire an expert for the analysis of the drug dog records, or is that something that you can do on your own?
If I ever had this come up again in a case where I would be litigating it in the forfeiture case, I would definitely do that if there was a if that's a pivotal issue, because there's nothing like winning a suppression motion to win the case. I mean, it's such a guaranteed win if you can win it. In most of the cases I have, there's a parallel criminal case, and usually the criminal defense lawyer wants to have that go first in the criminal case for obvious reasons. So I did not actually litigate myself the drug dog issue. That was won by the criminal defense attorney in the criminal case. Within 2 hours, the AUSA, I sent the AUSA in the forfeiture case an email saying, we just won the suppression motion, and less than an hour later, I saw the notice of dismissal e-filed. They weren't going to waste any more time, because if I'd had to go to court and say, this is enforceable, I would have been entitled to attorney's fees paid by the government, so they were not willing to let that go to a hearing.
I have a question. This is an interesting conversation because the Ohio courts have consistently held that a drug dog's real-world stats are completely irrelevant.
Stats are what?
Irrelevant. You're not even entitled to discover them. That's been Ohio's position for a number of years.
It seems to me that you have a confrontation issue since you're having to confront a drug dog and his expert witness testimony. And the other thing is, you know, the Fry test for scientific evidence. You should always look at that in relation to the drug dog test because it's not scientific if it's based just on a legal fiction that the drug dog is infallible.
I think you'd also have a Brady claim too. Because if you can get the records that show that the dog is messed up on his testing or whatever, that's exculpatory evidence.
Yeah, we can't even get him in discovery.
You should always prevail on getting not only the dog's training, but the dog's field training and the dog's testing, subsequent testing after he's been qualified. You should always get those records, at least in the federal case. Whether or not some states are qualified, they're critical to your examination of the dog.
But, by the way, what I'm talking about today are the rules for federal law. State law varies from jurisdiction to jurisdiction. There's just not enough time to cover those. Generally speaking, though, federal law influences state law. So if federal law sets the bar, then state law is going to not be any higher generally. All right. When you first get a forfeiture case, your clients probably wanting to know, what are my deadlines? How long is this going to take? What's it going to cost? What's the likelihood of my winning? Unless the forfeiture case has already been filed, which often hasn't happened yet, you can't answer that until the government decides which way they're going to go. They have all the advantages. They can file a civil forfeiture or a criminal forfeiture at their whim. I'm going to have to speed through this. It's kind of dry, but this is so important. In a civil forfeiture case, there are statutes making the government jump through hoops at a certain, with deadlines right at the very beginning of the case. So it will start moving forward right away, and the property owner will have to get involved and file claims and file answers and probably get discovery or get the case stayed. So it starts off like a roller coaster and you're moving. In criminal forfeiture, the criminal defendant, you know, it's just a criminal case, their forfeiture, bifurcated forfeiture, okay, will be decided at the end of the guilt phase. Third parties now have absolutely no rights to a hearing at all or to go into court or to do anything until after the criminal defendant is convicted and the property is forfeited. And the property can be forfeited based on the guilty plea of the criminal defendant who agrees to forfeit the property, yet third parties never get a chance to challenge the basis for the forfeiture ever in the case. We're probably not going to have time to cover the rest of these. I will skip over these. The pleading requirements are different. In civil forfeiture, they're at the beginning. In criminal forfeiture, they're after the criminal is convicted. Third parties have those rights. Jury trial rights, we already talked about some. There's no right to a jury trial, but third parties ever. Jurisdiction, this would take half an hour to explain, but the in-rim jurisdiction is that based on that biblical passage is for civil forfeiture, and that's unlike anything that any other kind of case ever handles, involves. That does not apply to criminal forfeiture, the in-rim provisions. Okay, here are the defenses very quickly. Suppression of evidence, we talked about. Innocent utter defense is statutory, and you have to look at the statute to see what the grounds are. Statute of limitations is also another way you can win. And proportionality, here's the Ninth Circuit case that I recommend that people look at, U.S. versus Farrow. They found that a wife of the criminal defendant, her culpability for the forfeiture of her part of the property is based on her almost innocent owner defense, even though she didn't have an innocent owner defense, so she didn't lose anything. That's a very important decision. Unfortunately, the rest of the, let me go back a second. Double jeopardy is not a defense anywhere except in New Mexico. Also, the legality of the activity under state law is not a successful defense in forfeiture cases. And for that reason, the feds are going after medical marijuana in California and have been like crazy for years. And they say, well, it's not legal federally. And I don't know if that's happening in Washington or Colorado, I hope not, but they certainly were mean-spirited in California. Often, the forfeiture takes so much money that the clients can't afford to hire you. How much time?
2 minutes.
Okay. You can still take a contingency case, though, but you have to be careful if there's a possibility the property owner will be charged criminally, because they may end up having to agree to forfeit their property, and then your contingency is going to disappear. Also, you'll have a conflict of interest if you have to negotiate the guilty plea and are giving up your fees or part of it. In civil forfeiture cases, there are two categories of claimants who are entitled to court-appointed counsel. That's very, very important. The judges don't tell people. If you don't know and don't ask, you never get them. Look at the statute if you have one of those cases. And then CAFRA attorney's fees, we don't have time to cover. So I'm going to move on through to, there's no court-appointed counsel for third parties ever, period. There's no CAFRA attorney's fees. Generally speaking, so far, no courts have held that the CAFRA attorney fees apply to third parties.
That issue is now presently before the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, actually.
Oh, good.
I just argued it last week.
Yay. Well, you know, every single stat takes years. That's the unfortunate part. They make up some new thing, and then we have to challenge it, and 6 years later, we find out that it's unconstitutional. All right, there's a forfeiture reform bill pending. I'll make this really, really quick. First two or three things are pretty important, but not so important. The very last one, this bill would take away forfeiture revenue from the cops. What do you think the chances are of winning? Let me blow this up. 0% chance, according to govtrack.us. 0% chance of winning. That's a poison pill. There's no way that it will be passed as long as that provision's in there, because the police lobby's too important, too powerful. I just need to say this very quickly. Even though I volunteer for FEAR, I no longer answer free questions. I have to quit that out completely because every single day people call me wanting my free advice. I had to just say no, none at all. Don't refer anyone to me to answer a few quick questions. I don't do it. You have to pay me by the hour, and I'll be retained for as little as half an hour to answer your questions. What I recommend, though, is FEAR has a number of low-cost materials. By the way, the FEAR's Asset Forfeiture Defense Manual is 500 pages. If you're ever doing any forfeiture case, that's only $119. That's worth getting. The DVD is $100. Brief Bank is $100 a year. You've got 250 motions and briefs and pleadings and discovery requests, and it's very, very useful if you're trying to learn from scratch. This What to Do ebook is only $5.99, and it answers the most frequently asked questions by forfeiture victims. I highly recommend you tell your clients to go on Amazon and buy this. All the proceeds go to benefit FEAR, and all these materials have kept FEAR afloat in a time when we've had no funding whatsoever. So I think I'm out of time.
You are.
Thank you.
Thank you.